Welcome back to I Got Ish to Say. We're sitting here with former drug kingpin Andre Mays. We're talking about his road to redemption. So Andre, when we talk about your illustrious career, what seemed to be illustrious, you know, you're at the top of your game, but when it all started falling down, let's talk about that.
Well, when it all started falling down, I didn't really have nothing to do with the situation. It's like the feds was looking to one guy who actually became the main witness against me in my federal trial. They wanted a guy who I would consider would have been one of my mentors, an older guy. And I guess they wanted him. And some type of way, they like, well, him and Dre close. And that's how they got on me. Which I didn't have nothing to do with the current situation, what the main witness, a Bahamian guy from Miami, you know, was doing, him and this other guy. You know, I didn't really have nothing to do with it. But they wanted the older guy. And they figured if anybody can happen to get the older guy, it would be me.
Right.
And this is something what I tell young dudes today. But now it seems like when I went to the feds and the feds now, it's different. I see dudes get out from stuff that back then, it's like, you know, they treated all of us like, you know, we was a part of a terrorist organization.
Right.
But I see guys get out from cases now. I know some of them tell. But then I don't, because I still read law cases to the day. And it's like the federal system just got a little lenient here. But like I say, they got on me because they wanted somebody else. And they figured if they get me, I was young, that, you know, I would tell. And, you know, when I went to trial, you know, I didn't tell.
Right.
But I tell guys, because people ask me, well, Dre, how did they get you? I said, well, first of all, when I went to trial, there was no drugs in my case, no phone tap, no wire tap. Nobody say that I had did a control buy to an undercover DEA or undercover JSO. You know, it was just all, you know, word of mouth. But I basically went to federal prison because they wanted another guy and because I was young, because everybody else, you know, was telling. So, you know, what made them think that, you know, I wasn't going to tell.
Right, right.
But, and a lot of people know, I'm not going to mention their names, but you know who my main man was back then.
Right.
Like everybody say, well, how'd Dre go down and they don't go down?
Right.
Did they play a part? No, man, it didn't play a part in me.
Right.
But it just show you how the federal, you know, government work.
So at this time, tell me about your personal life with it. Were there a fiance, with a wife or a main girlfriend, with the children? You know, what was that? What was Dre in a circle like, his family life?
Oh, well, you know, I'm an only child. And some people find that comical.
I thought you had a sister.
Well, you know, I got step-sister,
step-brother. Okay,
you
know? Okay, okay.
Yeah, but for my mother, you know, I'm an only child.
Okay.
So people be like, how this man was raised in a single home with a good mother, and he out in the streets doing all this and doing all that. But yes, you know, I had old lady. Well, I'm not going to lie. Some of them going to see this. You know, I had 3-4 old ladies.
Right, right.
And I had multiple kids. You know, basically all my kids, you know, the same age.
Right.
So, you know, that's how I was, you know.
So having the kids, and because you wasn't married to one woman, having the kids, did you ever say to yourself, what I'm doing might separate me from my kids, or the fact that you could do for your kids the way you could do made you go even harder?
Both.
A little bit of both.
Yes. Yes, both. Both. That's why now, after having the 18 and a half years in federal prison, that's why I say I would never do anything to be taken away. At 55, you know, I got an 8-year-old.
Right.
You know, I got like 22 grandkids. And the majority of them, we are extremely close. They call me every day.
Right.
Every day. So that's why now I look back, come forward, you know, I would never directly do anything to take them away from you.
The day you got sentenced, what was going through your mind? What kind of emotion you was going through the day the judge passed judgment on you?
Yeah, so basically, I never thought that I was going to get found guilty because they didn't have nothing on me. No phone tap, no wire tap, no control buys. But as years went on, I learned how the federal system worked. That don't mean nothing.
Right.
Because most time, the jury going to be all white. When I went to trial in 95, maybe I was 25. You got all white jury, same age my mother, clearly wasn't my peers.
Right.
Clearly didn't come from our community. But them people, they been the blind. They like, this is the federal government. So he had to do what they say that he did.
Right.
And then to have guys coming out sounding convincingly. And it's like, this is what I tell young guys too today. When it comes to the feds, if you got 20 witnesses going to testify against you, I guarantee you that 10 of them, you don't even know. But that's how the feds work. And, you know, that was like with me. Guys came in there who I never had dealt drugs with. And, you know, I was sentenced under the crack cocaine law, which was, you know, 101, you know, ratio. So, and it was just, you know, some of them guys, I look back on and laugh. They was lying, but they sounded, you know, convincing.
Convincing. Yeah.
So the jury's going to think they're telling the truth.
Right.
And like one, you know, particular guy, and I'm going to say his name because I don't give a fuck. Murkowski Clark.
Mm-hmm.
A super DEA informant. Mm-hmm. Outright lied on me. That's how I was able to be sentenced to the time I got, because of his testimony alone killed me.
Mm-hmm.
He outright lied. Outright lied. I mean, this man never dealt drugs before.
Right.
But the federal system, they don't have no type of safeguard. You know what they say? Oh, we're going to put it in front of the jury. Mm. And we're going to let the jury decide. So, and then at the time, I had a black female prosecutor, Kimberly Selmore. And she was a gung-ho U.S. attorney. And I'm not against her for her job. But I feel like that it was by any means necessary.
Right, right.
Especially when she found out I wasn't willing to cooperate. And I know she know a lot of dudes lied on me. All I'm saying, you know, give me a fair fight.
Right, right.
It ain't about being fair.
Right.
In the feds, it's about winning. Mm-hmm. And they're going to do anything to win. You know, some prosecutors' cases, where prosecutors and DEA agents done told witnesses to lie. You know, just to win a conviction. But like I say, in my case, you know, I just knew when I got found guilty, that day when I got found guilty, I was going to prison for a long time. And like, it's 2025. Well, you know, like I said, I was locked up on the 101 ratio. And this one guy who, I'm going to say his name, Murkowski Clark, he knew if he said crack, like he told the people, I sold him a half a kilo crack and a quarter kilo crack. Who back then was buying a half kilo crack and a quarter kilo crack? Well, you can buy half a kilo powder and you can turn it into a whole key because,
right,
you know, you could whip it.
Right.
But, you know, it was because of somewhere, I'm going to say, he was just a fuck nigga.
Right.
I'm going to just say. And me and him has kids, you know, from the same, you know, girl.
So it's personal.
Oh, yes. Yes, personal. Everybody knew it was personal.
Personal.
See, and that's why, you know, I don't hide this, you know, when I mention his name. Because you don't have to get in my business.
Right.
Then lie on me. Now, if I dealt with you, you know, it's guys who testified on me. Yes, we dealt. That's, as they say now, that's part of the game.
Right.
But what part of the game? You going to come in the courtroom and actually lie on the dude, take him away from his kids, take him away from his family.
It's interesting that you say that. It's part of the game. So you knew the risks in what you was doing, and you was willing to take the risks to continue to do what you was doing, knowing that this possibly could be your fate. Did you ever consider death might be your fate?
Almost definitely.
Yeah. Have you ever been robbed?
No, it been two attempts, but it ended in shootouts.
Okay.
Yeah.
But even with that, understanding the risks, the money outweighed the risk to you?
Almost definitely. But then, I always say back then, I used to ride motorcycles. Mm-hmm. But now I never ride a motorcycle because I value my life now. So
wow,
looking back on it, I didn't value my life.
Wow, that's you just said something major right there. Yeah. I had to pause on that one. You just said something major right there. You said, and I'm going to repeat, you said back then you rode motorcycles.
Right.
But now you won't because you value your life.
Right.
So things you did in your youth, now that you have matured, you're just not even going to do because the value you place on life itself is greater than it was then.
Oh, most definitely. I could have sex with 2-3 women a day, raw, back then. So I wouldn't do that now.
Definitely. Man. Trey, I need you to say that again. Because that was, out of this whole interview, that was, to me, was the most powerful thing. Thing, you was willing to take the risk of death, robbery, and prison because the value wasn't on your own life.
Right.
The money outweighed
almost definitely
the value. Day one in prison. How was that? Was it surreal or was you like, this shit ain't even true? Or day one, when the lights went out?
For sure. The first federal prison I went to was USP Allowance, a level four prison. I guess they were considered as a mics, but you know, extremely dangerous place. I'm saying, you know, my first day there, all the homies already knew I was coming.
Mm.
You know, homies from Jacksonville, homies from, you know, Miami, you know who I knew from the street. So, you know, when I got there, you know, they, you know, start schooling me, showing me the ropes. Because, you know, I never been to state. My first time going to prison was straight, you know, the federal prison. And, you know, I was young.
So it's fair what everybody say is barbecues and picnics and, you know, staying in a hotel or... Is the conditions is not bad at all? Is it like...
No, that's not true. In the federal prison, probably more people get killed in the federal prison than they do in state prison.
Okay.
Because my first day on the compound in Atlanta, I remember RIP to him, Ernest Miles, T-Bass from off Merrill Avenue. You know, when I get there, all the homies, oh, this is Lil Dre. This the homies, you know, Lil Dre. And probably the first 3 days I was there, shoot, the homie came and bought me a knife. He said, this is how I go down there, homie. We all stick together. And this is how I go down. If you go down, we all going down, you know. You know, we all going down this one.
Right.
You know, we from Duval. We don't let nobody disrespect us. So, you know, it just, it's a place where I don't want to see none of my grandsons go. Hmm. And me and my main partner were just talking last night. From when we was in federal prison to federal prison now, it done got more dangerous.
Mm.
So, like I say, I don't never want to see my grandsons have to experience that because they might not be able to handle it how I would handle it. And they might not be able to go to the extent and standing up and, you know, risking a life sentence. So, you know, I just never want to see them, you know, go through it.
Did you ever fear, and we're going to get into a little touchy subject, but did you ever fear having sons grow up and hearing the legend of Andre wanting to duplicate who the legend in the street was?
Yes, I feel that.
So from prison, how was your communication? How did you reach out and how did you try to prevent that from happening? I don't want you to repeat who I was. Don't live up to the legend. Don't live up to this kingpin status I had. I want something different. So what was your conversation as we segue into a painful part right now?
Sure. Just, you know, just making sure that, you know, they did well in school, you know, not, you know, getting in trouble. And from in prison, you can only do so much. And, you know, seeing them on visit, talking to them, because my mother made sure that I seen all my kids. Everywhere I've ever been in the federal system, you know, I always had visits. So in a lot of ways, I was fortunate because my mother was with me 100%. So, you know, just, you know, just trying to be the best father I could, you know, from behind the wall, you know, damn near, you know, with a 40-year sentence.
Was you able to leave a treasure chest behind for your family?
No. I'm going to be totally honest. Because I was dumb. I had the money, but I didn't really know what to do with it. And let me tell you this. When I was going to trial in 1995, I was in the Duval County Jail. Because, you know, I had a case in Atlanta, too.
Okay.
So when I finished that case in Atlanta, it brought me back, you know, to Duval. And I had a Sally. I never forget his name. I say Sally because, you know, that's jail talk.
Right, right, right.
But his name was Sean Ram Logan. He was Trinidadian, but he looked like an Arab. So one day he went out to wreck. He came back in. He said, "Hey, Dre, guys on the wreck, y'all was talking about you." I'm like, "What? What did they say?" They say, "Oh, you in the cell with that dude, Dre, you know, the big time drug dealer." I said, "Oh, I was getting money. Everybody was getting money. I want all that."
Right.
So he said, "Man, did you used to invest your money in the stock market?" Guess what I said?
No.
I said, "What's that?"
Wow.
He said, "Man, you don't know about the stock market? And you was a big drug dealer?" I said, "No, what's that?" Because he was, I think, a bank manager. He had stole some money down here in Jacksonville or something. So right then, I knew how dumb I was. And I said, when I get to prison, one of the first things I'm going to learn about is investing in the stock market. When I was in USP Atlanta, that's when I think it was MTV, the little MTV show used to come on in the morning. So I used to walk to one of the TV rooms, and it used to be a white dude in there. They called him a stockbroker. I could see him like it was yesterday. When the stock market come on, he'd be right in there watching the stock market. So I'm watching him. I'm listening to the TV. I see the black dudes come by. Oh, that crack in there with that little stock market shit. So, you know, I'm listening. So every morning I go in there with him. And he said, "You know about this?" I said, "No, I'm going to be honest." So he started teaching me a little shit. But then what really opened my mind to a guy, he's my mentor right now. Well, I consider him my mentor, but, you know, he like my big brother.
Right.
We talk every day. He called me right now 2-3 times a day.
Okay.
Name Eric Bozeman. They call him Los Angeles E.
Okay.
Real kingpin.
Okay.
A little around the world. First person taught me about Paris, about Nice, drinking 5,000 bottles of Petrus wine.
Okay.
So, you know, this guy, he's sharp. That's who really schooled me about the stock market and really laid down the groundwork. This is what you do. Read this book. You know, he the one really showed me the importance of reading.
Okay.
Because I hadn't read books. But this dude, like I said, I could sit to him today. I'm saying, you know, he like my big bro.
Right.
Which was my mentor.
Right.
That he really opened my mind to education, to the world, and one thing about investing in the stock market. Okay. It's like right now, you know, we talk every day when he say how proud he is of me. Because before he got out, I was already telling him about crypto.
Okay.
But I owe my transformation, really my whole transformation, the education, to him.
Okay.
Yeah.
So on the same vein of children, when you first heard about your first son, was you in prison when your first son was murdered?
No, I was here. You know, he got murdered. I've been out over 12 years.
Okay.
So no, I was working on the boat. I was offshore. And I was in the warehouse. Me, Captain Anthony, black guy, who's the captain. We was offshore. And my oldest son, Lil Dre Jr., he called me. He said, "Pop, you know I might get emotional." You know, he said, "Pop, X got shot." I said, "What the hell? How bad?" He said, "I don't know." I said, "Damn." And then everybody started calling me. And I think, oh, then his mother called me and said, "You home?" I said, "No, I'm on the boat." She said, "X got shot." I said, "I bet." She said, "I don't know. I don't think it's good." And his baby mama started calling me. Then my brother, who was police here, you know, he called me. I said, "Damn." Then my brother called me back. He like, oh, then my oldest daughter. My brother called me back. He said, it ain't good. He said, he ain't gonna make it. He said, he ain't gonna make it. He ain't gonna make it. I said, well, damn. I said, well, they know the captain and them. I said, well, the captain now. I say, they done called the office. They said they're gonna get me off tonight. And the job we was doing, they called it fast edit, where they just go up and down the ocean doing some type of tracking system. And it was a rap online. It was a rap on board from Chevron. And they see I hadn't got emotion then when they say he wasn't gonna make it. And I respect this dude, older white man. He said, stop the job right now. He called his office. He said, he getting off the smoke tonight. And we was out in the middle of nowhere. So they had to find an oil rig, you know, to get me to. And they told me, we're in the middle of nowhere. And the man, the oil rig is miles. So they said, just head to the nearest oil rig. And a crew boat met us, and they lifted me off the boat. Yeah, so, but you know, so, I told my brother, who was the police, I said, hey, just ask him, can they keep him alive till tomorrow?
Right.
He said, he bad. And he said, bro, I don't know if it's going to be good. I said, man, ask me to keep him alive till tomorrow. I say, because I'm going to get off the boat within the next few hours. I say, it's a crew boat finna meet us. So anyway, my brother called me back and say, he gone. So, you know, I clicked in. So anyway, you know, they got me off, you know, and you know, I flew back in. But though, you know, so, you know, he made it from the scene. Guy trying to kill his friend, kill my son. Out of three people, my son, I'm gonna get hit in the head, I think, once or twice. So he made it to the hospital. He was alive, you know, with his family there, his brothers, his sisters. And when his mother seen him, you know, she asked, the doctor, is that machine keeping him alive? And they said, yes. I think they knew her because she worked at the hospital before.
Right.
Maybe she worked it out.
Right.
And she told him to turn it off. Mm. He said, I don't want to suffer. So, yeah. So, you know, he died. Well, you know, that was 9/28/21.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Man, our condolences go out to you, man. That is, that is painful. So, not only did you have the tragedy of losing one son, you lost two sons.
Yes, two sons. Yes, my second son, Dreshawn Mays, was killed 10/23/23. Basically, you know, the same way, you know, the guy shot in the car, then my son, you know, he wrecked out and really died from the impact of, you know, the accident. But, you know, the case is kind of similar different because with the Xavier case, you know, two guys, you know, is locked up. Presently, they've been locked up for 3 years and they done set the trial date 3-4 times and maybe the trial will be this year. See, but the significant thing about the Xavier case, one of the guys who mother, well, she went to school with both of us.
Okay.
And me and this young lady was basically best friends. Matter of fact, me and her share a grandson together. From my son, Dreshawn, has a kid from, you know, has a son from her daughter. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, it just show how, you know, young guys do things and can impact not only them, but the parents. Because, man, this woman had a 30-year relationship.
Right.
Matter of fact, she testified at my federal trial on my behalf.
So how's the relationship now?
Oh, it's no relationship.
No relationship.
Yeah. None.
So that was a point, what you said too. A lot of times our youth don't understand the impact of the things they do. It can destroy, as you said, a 30-year relationship. A lady that came and testified on your behalf, now that relationship is severed because of things that the children have done.
Right, most definitely.
Is there a space for reconciling?
None. None.
Have they showed any remorse for what have happened? Or have they shifted blame?
I'm gonna say this. That's my issue with her. Mm. Because things were said. And now recently somebody told me that she admitted she was wrong. But, you know, I'm a Capricorn. So, and forgiveness is just not in me. Because certain things you should automatically know. If my sons were to kill anybody, first thing I'm going to do is keep my mouth shut.
Okay.
Because I know what they can lead to. Mm-hmm. And the problem with, I'm going to say, black society now is, this in a lot of cases, the murderer, parent, they play victim. How can you play victim when your son charged with, you know, the crime? And not just me. I'm saying I see numerous cases like this all the time.
Right.
I'm saying you mad because your son killed somebody. Maybe you need to check, you know, what was going on inside, your house. And this is what I tell people. In our community, nobody want to tell the next person that they wrong. Nobody. And that's a problem. Nobody want to tell the next person that they wrong. And that's why when people say blackness, come together, this and that, sometimes I say, man, that's a whole bunch of bullshit. Because nobody in the black community want to say, know what, you wrong. You wrong. You know, you need to be checked. Hey, I don't know. I don't know if it that trickled down from slavery or what, I don't know.
But that's a good point. And I want to ask a question, and it's not to demean anything that you said, but when you was at the height of your career,
mm-hmm.
and you making thousands of dollars, you said at one point you was making $5,000 an hour, did anybody come to you and say, Dre, it's wrong, you destroying the community?
Almost definitely.
And when you heard that, what was your reply?
Man, I ain't trying to hear that shit.
Okay. So you're in prison now. And taught the ropes, what to do, what not to do, who to stick with, who not to stick with. Well, what was that turning factor to say, you know what, it's time for Dre the Kingpin to become Dre the Man?
Like I said, my partner, Los Angeles Z, you know, learning from him. Like I said, he'll do it and travel around the world. And you know, he's a real...
Well, what year was it for you? How many years were you in prison before the transformation started?
Oh, I'll probably say, so I think I did like close to 8 years in this PLM.
Okay.
In the pen, seven and a half. Probably 4 or 5 years in.
Okay.
Because me and this guy were Sally's.
Okay.
So the guy get books. And, you know, I would also read some of these books. So, and you know, I started seeing things, you know, different. And not only him, I had other mentors. Mm-hmm. One of them who was on the speaking circuit now after doing 36 years, Wayne Prey, a.k.a. Artbar, you know, from Newark, you know, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. You know, I was young, so they liked me. And like Artbar used to always say, Dre, man, you really one of the first young dudes, so I know that ain't no rap.
Right.
So, you know, them dudes took a liking to me. So, you know, I would learn certain things from them, you know, about businesses and so forth. And also, you know, Matulu Shakur, R.I.P., you know, he with the ancestors now, Tupac's stepdad.
Right.
So, you know, I would walk the track, you know, with them and learn. And I knew a lot of that nigga ghetto shit, if I was to get out again, you know, I couldn't still have that same, you know, mentality.
Right.
Matter of fact, Artbar, wrote a book called The Death of the Game. Mm-hmm. He talking about me, him, E, and Matulu in there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those guys who I was able to meet and Ike with, first because they knew I wasn't a rat.
Right.
And, you know, I learned, you know, from them. That's why I always tell people, I wouldn't trade them 18 and a half years for nothing. They was the best 18 and a half years of my life for real. Because if I still would have been out here in the street, I'd still been dumb. Mm-hmm. Or as they say, deaf, dumb, and blind. Mm-hmm. I probably had AIDS. Mm-hmm. I'd probably be on death row. Or maybe I'd be killed. Mm-hmm. Maybe I would have been killed.
So you didn't have the mentality that most of the kingpins have when they come out, that I'm coming back in power. Because I had a kingpin tell me one particular time, he said, I may have lost money, but I never lost power. And I always know the pockets to go to get the money with the power. So your mentality coming out was never to restore Andre the Kingpin. Your mentality was, it's time for me to accept responsibility and be Andre the man, not just for myself, but for my family as well.
Oh, most definitely. Because like I said, you know, my mother was there 150% for me. Mm-hmm. So I always knew if I ever got out again, I had to change. Mm-hmm. And check this out. A few dudes, when I first got out, they say, boy, I know you got to connect. Mm. Like, I think I just did 18 years. The fuck do you mean? You know I got to connect. Oh, man, you finna get out and work? Yeah, most definitely. I just went to trial for almost a month. 14, 15 dudes coming to half of them lying on me. They ain't have nothing on me. You think I'm finna give some more suckers another chance to get off on me like that? No, bro. I wrote 2-3 jobs first. So, no. I didn't really want to have nothing else to do with the streets. Mm. Because I had to learn that street shit is, first of all, it's a mistake. It ain't nothing about it that's real. Because the so-called street dudes are the most fakest niggas that it is. Most street dudes are rats. They don't stand on no morals. They don't stand on no principles. So why would I want to be a part of that again? Yes, I could have had 3-4 connects. You know, I used to have Columbians because they knew I wasn't no rat.
Right, right.
When you get out, blah, blah, blah. You know, I would shine them off. But I'm going to be honest, too. When I first got out, it wasn't easy. Mm-hmm. Trying to get on my feet. And I questioned myself. I said, damn, I made a mistake. I should have got that motherfucker. But then I was shaking, you know. And, you know, just move on. But no, what I tell people, them 18 years I did, 18 and a half years I did, I wasn't trading for nothing in the world. So, because it shaped me for who I am,
right?
For who I am, you know, today.
So it's sort of like destiny or fate placed you in that circle of men that you was around and really grow you.
Almost definitely.
Oh, because if it had not been for those mentors and that shaping,
that's right,
those conversations, you probably would have came back and say, I'm finna do it bigger than I did it before.
For sure. And you know, that could have been done. And like I say, you know, I was out before, you know, my partner, who I'm gonna say E. I was out before Outball, because Outball, you know, just got out. Mm-hmm. And another guy who I consider as a mentor named Peter, he the one who the book, The Coldest Winter Ever, you know, was based off of. So, you know, I got mad love for them dudes. Because honestly, them dudes in their 70s set my partner E. He like 61.
Okay.
So, you know, I looked at them dudes as a father figure. The father, you know, I know who my father is, but, you know, he wasn't ever there.
Right.
So, and like I say, these was excrete dudes, educated, made changes. So, you know, I just basically learned and followed, you know, the groundwork that, you know, that they laid out.
So, have you ever thought about, okay, what's the next phase for Dre? You know, do you write a book? Do you write a movie? Or what is the next phase for Dre?
Well, I have wrote like 2 novels. And one of my sons, he always said, Pop, man, when you gonna publish the novels? dealing with everyday life, working, focus on getting money, being a father, not being a father slash grandfather, the kids that my sons left off. Like, when my son Xavier had $5, mm-hmm. you know, from the age of, Pat was like 3 months old, you know, when he got killed. So, you know, being a father slash grandfather, and I'm still working. I don't really have the time that I should dedicate to my writing, but I was just saying last night that I'm probably gonna give myself another 2.5 years working offshore, and then that's gonna be my life, you know, that's writing. But I got a movie script role and everything. So, but like I said, I don't put the time in it to really get it out there like I should. And numerous people done asked me about writing a book about my life story. So, and that's another thing that I said this year that, you know, I'm gonna get on.
When you look at your life as a whole, what is your main regret?
Main regret is getting in the streets. It's selling drugs. That's why now I tell guys, and it'd be funny to them, I say, selling drugs is for dummies. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm gonna say when you know better, you know, I'm saying, you know, you can't expect a person to read a book who never been taught to read. But when you know better, when you know what the game brings, I'm saying, why would you want to indulge it in the game?
We talked about, prior to going live, we talked about, as you said it then, that you'll never trade those 18 years for anything. And you talked about people we know, we went to school with, who was in the streets, didn't do any time, but can't even read on a third grade level.
All right. You know, people say I got a habit of calling people dumb. Because I do. I say, you know, a lot of niggas dumb.
Right.
Yeah.
So now, because a lot of people, and you're saying so many key things, a lot of people, they glorify this drug life. They glorify the things that they perceive this drug life give right. them. But from a kingpin at 16 years old, $200,000-$300,000 saved up and driving these fancy cars, you can say to them that that's not the route you want to go. Why?
Because it don't have no longevity in it. And it's like you playing chess. Me and you playing chess, but I'm cheating. Mm-hmm. But you don't know I'm cheating.
Right.
But you can say, man, why I can't win? But I'm cheating. I done been taught how to cheat.
Right.
You say, damn, I know he ain't cheating, I can't, but I'm cheating. You know, it's no win. Street life is no win. And I look back when I was young, I could never imagine saying this because, you know, my life was based on being street. Mm-hmm. You know, it was based on being Andre Mays. But man, that shit for dummies. Because you're not gonna win. My life is about winning.
Right.
I'm saying life is about elevation. I'm saying then overall it's for dummies. And then you're gonna get played. They're going to make you put on a dress. They're going to make you be less than a man. Mm. Then you're going to be in prison, 50, 60, 70 years old. You might even die in that shit. You know how many good dudes I seen die in prison for simple shit that people on the street going to die from?
Wow.
So, no, that shit for dummies and suckers. Dudes who already rats are dudes who going to be rats. And this is what I tell people. If it's 100 people in the community selling drugs, 95 of them already working. Mm. It's a professor from Northwestern. And I put it up last week when me and one of my partners talking. Man, she say if it's a gathering in the black community, over 80% of the people that are already working with law enforcement. And that's embarrassing for the black community.
Wow.
Yes. So you think, like I say, when you know better, you do better. Now, if you've never been taught to read, I can't give you a book and tell you to read.
Right.
But a person that know better, why would you even want to indulge in that? So, and you know, that would be me. And some people actually thought, but when I got out, I was going to go back to the same thing. No, I ain't no sucker. I may be a lot of things, but I ain't no sucker. One thing about Myra, she ain't raised no dummy. You know, she might have raised the asshole, because people say I'm an asshole.
Right, right.
But a dummy? No. You know, like I said, and I never give suckers another chance to take me away from my kids. Mm. Because now I value being a father. Even though, you know, my older kids grown, you know, my oldest daughter, Jasmine, like 35, 36. And, you know, she got four kids. You know, she got a 1-year-old, but the oldest three love me to death. And two of them done lost a father, you know, to gun violence. So, no, I feel like I'd be a pure sucker if I put myself in a position to be taken away from my daughter and my grandkids. And yes, I would love to have another $500,000, $700,000 saved up. Nah, I wrote three jobs. Try to get it down.
So when the story of Andre Mays, and when you talk about the legacy, what do you want, as we conclude this, what do you want Andre Mays' legacy to be?
To be known as a man, somebody who never compromises morals and principles, you know, somebody who stand on business, and somebody who came home with the goal up doing right. Like I said, the only thing that brought me close back to the street is when my son was killed. You know, I was ready to go back and be who I was back then. That's why I tell people, really? See, the devil had been asleep and killing my son. You know, they really awakened the devil. But you know, I just want to be known as a man. That's why I never compromise morals and principles. And protecting my name as a man, Andre Mays, I don't really see nothing more important than that. And, you know, to lay down a foundation for my 8-year-old daughter, my grandkids. That's why I move a certain way. I don't put myself out there. I don't go certain places, because it's like when my son got killed. I had dudes calling me from prison. Stayed and fed. Don't come back. Don't come back to prison. I know you want to swing the block. I know you are swinging the block. Don't come back to prison. They say, I know it's hard, Dre. Don't come back to prison. They like, man, they got friends. You know, let the streets happen. I know it's hard, Dre. Hey, I'm talking about dudes calling me every day. Hey, are you good? Yeah, hey, don't lie to him. Dude, don't come back. One dude told me, if you come back in here, you a sucker. I said, man, it killed my boy. He said, man, that streets happen. So, you know, that was the love from older dudes.
Right, right.
You know, keeping me, you know, in check. Yeah, but you know, I can say, it's not more than me now to lay down a foundation for my 8-year-old and my grandkids.
So the road to redemption is a road that you have to choose every day.
Oh, most definitely. I'm saying life for me is like playing the perfect chess game. Mm. One wrong move, it can all be over.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man, you know, Dre, I appreciate you, man, for one, pushing me.
Yeah.
And two, you know, not taking our friendship lightly to say I'm going to go tell my story on Peanuts Podcast.
Right.
Today I was enlightened. I was encouraged. This was a conversation that's gonna impact young men, because they need to hear the story. You know, sometimes people stand in front of these groups and they don't even know what these kids are faced with. But you've been there.
Right.
You lived it. You've been at the highs, you've been at the lows, and now you're rebuilding. So this conversation right here is going to be very impactful, encouraging, and it's going to give some direction to a young man who think that they want to be the next Andre Mays kingpin. But then after they hear you talk, they're going to be Andre Mays, the man who rebuilt his life from nothing.
Wow.
And showed him what true success is. So, man, I appreciate you for coming on today. Appreciate you for telling your story. And I look forward to having more conversations. I want to talk when this book come out. I want to come bring you back, and we're going to talk about the book, man. But I appreciate you.
For sure.
And thank you. Thank you for joining in. I got ish to say. I told you it's going to be powerful. It's going to be impactful. It's going to be controversial. Tune in for the next episode. I Got Issues to Say with Alfonso McClendon. Thank you.